Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you expert insights from a multidisciplinary team on novel immunotherapeutic approaches for non-driver mutation metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Plus, hear from a patient advocate on the importance of shared decision-making and how to best support patients throughout their treatment journey. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from AstraZeneca and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, a medical oncologist, an oncology pharmacist, and a pathologist discuss the challenges associated with current standard of care immunotherapy for patients with non-driver mutation metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
Hello, everybody. My name is Professor Raffaele Califano. I'm a medical oncologist at the Christie and Manchester University Hospital in Manchester in the UK. I'm joined today by Professor Holly, who is an oncology pharmacist and professor of clinical pharmacology at the University of Connecticut and UConn Health in the United States, and also joined by Professor Stenzinger, who is a pathologist and professor of molecular tumor pathology at Heidelberg University in Heidelberg, Germany. In this section, we will discuss the current first-line standard of care immunotherapy landscape and also the unmet needs for patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer without driver mutation. It is pretty clear that over the last few years, a number of treatment options have now been approved in the clinical practice in the first-line space. And I would like to ask Professor Holly to comment on the potential options that we have, you know, from an American point of view, but also from a European point of view, please.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, we know that first-line therapy in the metastatic setting for non-small cell lung cancer without actionable mutations really lends itself to using immunotherapy. And we have guidelines in the United States called the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, and then in the European setting, the European Society for Medical Oncology guidelines. And both guidelines really offer immunotherapy as a first-line option, particularly monotherapy in patients who have a high expression of PD-L1, so 50% or greater. And we're talking about also in patients who have a good performance status, because these patients need to be able to be functioning well, to be able to tolerate therapy and have a good effect. And then when patients who have a lower PD-L1 expression, so less than 50% by the ESMO guidelines, and NCCN guidelines uses 1-49%, and still a good performance status, you can combine immunotherapy with chemotherapy or do a dual immunotherapy combination. In those with less than 1% PD-L expression, those patients may not do as well with immunotherapy. We can talk a little bit more about specifics of drugs. But in the NCCN guidelines in the United States, we recommend using chemotherapy in that population. So overall, our guidelines are very similar between the two organizations, but immunotherapy is a standard of care now in the metastatic setting in those patients without mutations. I thought, Dr. Califano, if you could talk a little bit more about some of the data supporting those immunotherapy options, that would be helpful.
And all these phase 3 randomized clinical trials have clearly shown that with immunotherapy-based strategy, you have a higher response rate, almost double than what you would expect with chemotherapy. The response rates are now in the range of 45 to 50%. But there's also a clear impact on overall survival, not only as a median overall survival. We see now a number of patients surviving longer than 3 years. And for example, recent 5 years follow-up data from the chemoimmunotherapy studies with pembrolizumab, for example, have shown that approximately 20% of patients who were in the chemoimmunotherapy arm will still be alive at 5 years, which is unprecedented if you think that we are discussing about advanced non-small cell lung cancer without an oncogenic driver. On the other hand, though, as a matter of fact, 20 to 30% of the patients will progress through their first-line immunotherapy-based strategy, and these are patients with primary resistance. And I believe there's an unmet need to either select in a better way patients for the right strategy, but also there's an unmet need in finding alternative therapeutic strategies to try and improve the outcomes for our patients. I would like to ask from a pathology perspective to Professor Stenzinger, what can we use to select patients most likely to benefit from these immunotherapy strategies, and including, you know, some immunostains, but also the potential role of molecular testing with next generation sequencing?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I think if you look across, you know, solid tumor types beyond non-small cell lung cancer, there are, you know, three different biomarkers currently approved, at least in the United States, which is the MSI status, MSI high / DMMR, then TMB as one of these genomic biomarkers, and as a third biomarker, PD-L1 immunohistochemistry. Now, if you focus and narrow in a little bit on non-small cell lung cancer, I think it's fair to say, given that the, you know, prevalence of microsatellite instability is very, very low, that it's really only PD-L1 immunohistochemistry that does play a role in that context. You have to be, you know, careful in terms of, you know, the different antibody clones from an immunohistochemistry standpoint, that you need to factor them in, and also that you are familiar with the different cut points and more particularly the different scoring systems that are out there. So the, you know, the tumor proportion score, for example, plays a predominant role, but there are also other scores like the IC score, depending on the treatment, obviously, and the line of therapy. The, you know, other major pillar is really the exclusion of major drivers. So that's probably one thing really to keep in mind. So testing of, for example, ALK gene fusions is very critical, because we do know that these patients, so tumors harboring these gene fusions, do not respond very well to immunotherapy, more specifically immune checkpoint blockade. So maybe, you know, these are to me the two major aspects, and that clearly also shows you that we still have some work to do in terms of how to actually mirror the complexity of the tumor host or tumor immune cell interaction on a biomarker side more precisely than we are doing right now.
Thank you very much. And I think you've touched on a very relevant point from a clinical practice point of view, is the need to have your molecular results, including PD-L1, but also EGFR, ALK, ROS1, BRAF, MET, for example, before you plan your strategy. And this is very important, in particular, if you have a patient with a light smoking history or are never smokers, because what you don't want to do is to make the mistake of starting patients on immunotherapy, single agent, for example, just on the basis of a high PD-L1 expression, and then 3 weeks later, the tumor harbors an EGFR activated mutation. You're doing a major disservice to your patients if you started someone on immunotherapy, you know, on the basis of a high PD-L1 expression, whilst on the other hand, there is an oncogenic driver, and that's what is driving the tumor and needs to be addressed. So thank you for touching on that. And this is very clear in US-based and EU-based guidelines that when possible, you should get the results of your molecular testing in a timely fashion before you plan your first line treatment. And Professor Holle, I don't know, from a clinical point of view, do we have any clinical characteristics that will make you think I should choose combination strategies compared to single agent strategies?
Well, I think sometimes it also depends upon the patient's performance status, as I mentioned when we were talking about the guidelines. The combination strategies will have more toxicity associated with them. So those patients who have a better performance status are more likely to do well on a combination therapy. The toxicity profile differs as well. I think those are all really important factors. So speaking of toxicity, I think we know that the combination or dual checkpoint inhibitors have a higher incidence of immune-related adverse events than single-agent immunotherapy agents. The immune therapy toxicity is much different than what we think of with traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. It can affect essentially any organ, causing an autoimmune-like response. And we do know that the incidence of grade 3 and 4 immune-related adverse events can actually be associated with a higher overall survival rate than those who don't have those. So although we don't want our patients to experience high-grade toxicity and have to potentially stop therapy, there may be some benefit in those patients who do have those toxicities. So that is an interesting sort of conundrum you can be in when you're treating patients as well.
And thanks for touching on that, because as a clinician, when you mention to the person in front of you that unfortunately you have to stop their active treatment due to safety reasons, understandably, you know, the patient will be quite upset and concerned about losing that safety net, which was for them that regular 3-weekly, 4-weekly, or 6-weekly regimen. There is a retrospective data to suggest that patients who have to discontinue an immunotherapy-based combination due to high-grade immune-related adverse events, despite discontinuing the infusions, they may still derive a long-term benefit, because realistically, once the immune system is primed, you may have a carryover effect. So I do use that piece of information, a bit retrospective, to sort of reassure the patients that the treatment may still continue to work, and there is a number of case reports or series to support that, even if the drug has been discontinued. So thank you very much. I think we've had a very good discussion around these clinical points. I would like to thank the faculty for their input, and you can find out about more immunotherapeutic approaches for the treatment of advanced non-small cell lung cancer without an oncogenic driver mutation in other short videos on this activity. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on non-small cell lung cancer on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com. Don't forget, there are 3 other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.